Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 25, Tribal Ways. Narrated by Nanette Savard, with performances by Colleen Delaney, Thomas Penny, Jeff Allen, Thomas Keegan, Lily Beacon, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, Joseph Thornhill, Kimberly Gilbert, Michael Glenn, M.B. Van Dorn, James Konacek, Greg Gorton, Michael John Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, James Lewis, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Demery, Johan Detweiler, Dolores King-Williams, Scott McCormick, Ken Jackson, and Terrence Aselford.
Paul Stavriakos stood in the open door of the RV with a mug of coffee steaming in his hand.
Damn never-ending wind. What the hell were we thinking, moving to the Great Plains?
Allison York rustled in the bed behind him.
Either go or stay, but shut the damn door. The wind is freezing.
Paul stepped down to the grass, still dry and tan from winter. He shut the door behind him. Dawn was still a drizzle of red along the horizon. Clouds hid the stars overhead. The land was all tilted plains. It was flat in a way, but flat that tipped this way and that in big plates furred in yellow-brown grass. There wasn't much relief, but it was deceptive land, with more hollows and heights than first struck the eye.
Not enough to cut the damn wind, though.
Lights appeared in the trailer that Donnie Luttrell shared with Tijan Watts. The battered Toyota pickup with the camper shell, belonging to Dr. Ted Watkins from the State Archaeological Division, was rocking on its suspension more than the wind's buffeting would account for. Paul hoped he was pulling on his jeans. The muffled swearing coming from inside seemed to support that thesis.
Ever wonder why those old Indians picked a miserable spot like this to make their camp?
Paul turned. Eric James was swinging off the back of his old buckskin gelding. He wore a sheepskin coat and a battered felt cowboy hat. The hair hanging in thick braids to either side of his head was gray as slate. The wide face between, the color of Oklahoma clay, had a tough and weathered quality, but was barely lined. A full-blooded Comanche and full-time rancher, he owned the land where they stood. He returned to his saddle for a moment, then turned back to Paul. He held white bags with a colorful logo in each hand.
Brought donuts for you kids. Hope you make decent coffee. Wasn't carrying that in my saddlebags.
Paul smiled. It felt as if ice was cracking off his face. The digging season seemed to start earlier each year. The ground wasn't fully frozen. That was about all you could say for it. Then again, he thought, it's getting harder and harder to beat the protesters out here. Digging in colder and worse weather was one way of keeping them at bay as long as possible. Even so, they'd be out there with their signs and their shouting as soon as the day warmed up. Tijan started down the steps of a trailer wearing jeans and a t-shirt.
Ooh, damn, it's cold!
He popped back inside like a startled prairie dog. A second-generation Haitian from Miami, Tijan didn't quite get winter, even if it was supposed to be spring on the Great Plains. Like an unlovely butterfly from its cocoon, Ted emerged from his camper. Unlike their host, his face looked as if each of his 50 years had stomped it hard on the way out the door. He was skinny, with long, dark blonde hair hanging out from his grimy Sooners ball cap, white stubble sticking out of his long chin, and gaunt cheeks. He wore a drab plaid lumberman's jacket. He completed his ensemble with faded blue jeans over pointy-toed cowboy boots.
Another lovely day in western Oklahoma. Christ.
Paul winced as the older man unwrapped a piece of gum and popped it into his mouth. Ted was trying to quit smoking. Apparently, gum was his designated substitute crutch. Allison started out from the RV. Like the trailer, it was owned by their employer, the University of Oklahoma at Norman. Unlike the trailer, it was at least relatively modern. Since Paul and Allison were the assistant professor and graduate student on the dig, they claimed it by right of rank. Allison had a red wool knit cap pulled down over her long, straight blonde hair and a white Hudson's Bay blanket with big, bold stripes of blue, yellow, green, and red wrapped around her slim frame. Gray sweatpants showed below the bottom of the blanket above fleece-lined moccasins.
Hey, Allie, could you make more coffee?
He didn't speak loudly, partly out of consideration for Allison, but mainly to keep his own head from cracking open. They probably shouldn't have drunk quite so much last night, he thought. Indeed, they shouldn't have been drinking inside the RV at all, since it was contrary to university policy. Not that it's the only rule we're breaking, he thought. And what the hey, we have proud archaeologist traditions to uphold. Allison scowled. The spanking of the cold wind was making her cheeks red and her blue eyes water.
Why me?
Because you're still mostly inside where it's warm. And we have the only coffee maker that works.
Chauvinist. Did your girlfriend who's coming to visit make you coffee?
She turned and went back inside.
She's not my girlfriend. She's just an old friend.
Actually, Anya Creed was a young friend. She was a year or two younger than Paul. They'd met on a dig 4 years ago. Sparks had flown. The fire they kindled flamed up and flamed out. The end. Now she was a semi-famous cable TV personality and globe-trotting archaeologist, coming out at his request to touch bases and look the dig over. Inviting her hadn't even been his idea. It had been at the department's request, in the probably unrealistic expectation that the resident expert on chasing history's monsters might bring some good publicity their way.
Women.
Donnie had emerged from the trailer to stretch and yawn. Like an outsized, nearsighted cherub with his dark, curly hair and beard, his thick lens glasses, and his belly sticking out between his green and white University of North Dakota t-shirt and sweatpants. He was a cold-weather guy and liked to show off his indifference to low temperatures. He wore sandals on otherwise bare feet.
You can't live with him, you can't...
We, New Manu, have an old tradition.
Eric interrupted, using the Comanche word for his people.
We kill anybody, says a cliche. Scalp them, too.
Paul tried not to wince. Native Americans on campus usually believed, or at least said, all the right things. Outside the university, those he met, almost to a man and woman, defiantly called themselves Indians and expressed contempt for political correctness in any form. You just had to get used to it. And for what it was worth, Eric seemed genuinely friendly. For one thing, he let them dig his land, invited them to when he accidentally unearthed the Paleo-Indian site, in the face of rising rumblings of opposition from some of his people. For another, he brought donuts, even if they were bad for you. Paul looked to Eric.
Really nice of you to be okay with us digging up your ancestors, dude.
Not my ancestors. We didn't live here then. Neither we or the Kiowa ran off the people whose ancestors these were around 300 years ago.
Eric shook his head.
Well, one good thing about this damn cold wind, it'll keep the professional Indians inside by their space heaters for a while. As much money as I give to the nation every year, the loafs about the fort got nothing better to do than send me death threats and try to trespass so they can pick at me on my own land.
Donnie, are you crazy, man?
Tijan approached, his voice, muffled by the layers of clothing he had donned before venturing forth again, rose perilously near to cracking. He was a freshman, only nominally out of adolescence.
Why don't you got nothing on your feet?
He was staring in horror at his roomie's feet.
Jesus, Tijan. What are you, dressed to scale Everest?
Ted looked Tijan up and down.
For Sweden.
The Floridian undergrad wore a blue and yellow parka with fur-clad hood over his head. Allison emerged from the RV bearing a tray with a pot of coffee and an assortment of chipped and colorful mugs.
All right, you big, strong, helpless men. The woman comes to the rescue.
Ah, the stuff of life itself.
Allison held the tray while the rest crowded around.
Best leave some for me if you don't want to wind up wearing it. Whoa. Does anybody hear a hissing?
Wow, donuts.
Donnie's eyes belatedly lit on the two paper bags Eric had left on the grass.
Yeah, I do. Strange.
Midway to the donuts, Donnie froze.
Don't tell me there's a snake.
Who's a wimp now, Eskimo boy? Afraid of a little itty-bitty snake?
Whoever heard a snake hiss that continuously?
Or that loud. We'd hear it over this wind.
Wait. Did you guys see a shadow move? Over there to the left.
Shadow?
Paul felt an inexplicable chill that had nothing to do with the wind.
Yeah, I thought I saw something out of the corner of my eye, like a dog or something.
Shit, that'd be a big dog.
They were all turning and staring around. Paul felt a little woozy. Maybe he was turning too fast, getting dizzy.
We should all chill.
Paul noticed that Eric James had drawn the slab-sided .45 automatic he wore on his hip and was holding it two-handed with its muzzle tipped toward the unfriendly sky. His face was the consistency of stone.
This is starting to freak me out.
Paul spun toward Allison. As he did, something hot splashed across his face. For a moment, he thought she'd thrown scalding coffee on him. Then the darkness hit him. It was all over the flat-screen TVs hung from the rafters and tuned to CNN when Anya entered the airport terminal. Five dead and one gravely injured in an inexplicable attack on an archaeological dig in western Oklahoma.
It's so tragic about those other poor people. Does it make me a bad person that I feel glad that Paul's the one who survived?
She hadn't been coming to rekindle any old embers. It had been good with Paul while it lasted, and when it was done, it was over. He was still a sweet guy, if a little bit of a player, and a good archaeologist on the tenure track at the university. Now she just hoped he was still on any track at all. She collected her single black bag.
I was due for a little relaxation here.
She walked briskly through the crowds toward the car rental desk. Because of the severity of his injuries, Paul had been taken by helicopter from the site west of Lawton to the trauma unit in Norman, right outside Oklahoma City. Finding the trauma center wasn't hard. Once inside, amid the bright lights and muted sounds and quietly purposeful traffic of the hospital, things got a little dicier. The staff initially tried to keep Anya from seeing Paul in intensive care. It seemed to be a well-run facility, so Anya didn't even try playing her journalist cum TV personality card. It was never her first choice in any event. But Paul's family had yet to arrive, given that the crime had actually occurred while she was in transit from New York to Houston. His next of kin, it seemed, would only arrive late that evening. Though the nurses wouldn't say so, Anya got the sickening impression they didn't expect him to live long enough to see them. In the meantime, Paul was asking incessantly for Anya Creed, so his doctors and the police officer in charge of the case agreed to let her in. Sunlight streamed through the window. The early online weather reports had showed clouds over western Oklahoma, but they'd dissipated by the time her flight touched down. Paul was all tubes and bandages and taped on wires. Half his face was obscured by a bandage. But his good brown eye was open. It turned toward her as she walked in the door.
Anya.
He tried to sit up.
Paul.
Anya stopped in the doorway, momentarily overcome. The nurse who had escorted Anya to the room, a short, wide woman, moved past Anya. Though a head shorter, she was heavy enough to push Anya aside as if she were a child. Anya frowned, but held her temper. She's doing her job, she told herself.
Now, Paul, calm down.
The nurse turned and glared back with narrowed blue eyes.
Miss Creed, I'm afraid you're going to have to cut short your visit after all.
No. Please, Rosalie, please. I have to talk to her. I have to tell her.
Okay. He seems to really need to get something off his chest. It may be good for him to have company. I'll give you 5 minutes. And I do not want you stressing my patient. Please, tell me you understand.
Anya took no offense at the woman's words or her tone. A good nurse had the same outlook on anyone or anything that might prove detrimental to her patients as a mother grizzly bear toward potential threats to her cubs.
I understand.
And Anya did, perfectly. Herself a chronic defender of innocence, she could only approve of the nurse's protectiveness. The nurse looked at her a beat longer, then she nodded.
All right. Call me if any changes happen. I'll be right outside.
The nurse left. Anya sidestepped to give her plenty of clearance. Then she moved forward and took Paul's unbandaged hand.
Paul, what happened?
The torn lips quirked into a painful smile.
Something right up your alley, Anya.
What's that, Paul?
Suddenly, his fingers clenched hers in a death grip.
A monster.
For a mad moment, she thought he was making a joke well beyond good taste. But his lone visible eye showed white all around, and a tear rose in the corner of it and rolled down his cheek. His whole body seemed to tense.
Paul, please, calm down.
No, there's no time. There's something out there, Anya. Something awful. It killed them.
What did?
His fingers dug into her hand.
That creature.
Paul, please, settle down. You're getting upset and not making any sense.
Anya, I saw it. It was a wolf, but it wasn't. Sometimes it seemed like a man, sometimes like an animal. And it killed and killed.
That's just the movies.
No. It looked like a wolf, but it didn't move like one.
He shook his head from side to side so violently, Anya was afraid he'd pull something loose.
It was terrible. Oh, God, it killed him. It was so fast, so strong, not anything natural.
Why would a wolf attack such a large group of people?
It made no sense to her that a solitary member of a pack-hunting species would attack multiple human beings. It totally reversed the whole mathematics of wolf predation.
It wasn't natural, I tell you. It wasn't an animal.
His eye rolled.
Anya, listen, it wasn't an animal. It wasn't, and it's hunting me.
He sat up and grabbed her arm with his good hand.
It was a skinwalker, a Navajo wolf. I saw his eyes, those glowing.
Paul seemed to shrink, then fell back onto the bed. His one visible eye stared at the ceiling.
What's your interest in this poor deceased fellow, Miss Creed?
Lieutenant Tom Tenbears of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol sat down behind the plain wooden desk in his office. He had the unmistakable look of an officer who'd spent many years with the force. Not a tall man. He was built strong and low to the ground, short in the legs, wide around the middle, suggesting still both strength and a certain agility. Anya sat across from him in a not very comfortable wooden chair. It reminded her way too much of being called before the Mother Superior back at Our Lady of Perpetual Sorrow. She suspected the visiting the principal effect wasn't entirely accidental.
We're friends, Lieutenant. We're friends.
The Highway Patrol officer's round, pockmarked face, beneath a salt-and-pepper military cut, was set in lines and contours of grave compassion. He probably gets a lot of practice with that look in his line of work, she realized. It also didn't mean he didn't feel it. The office walls were wood paneling. An Oklahoma State flag hung behind him, along with a plaque in the arrowhead shape of the OHP patch, certificates of completion from training courses, and numerous citations, including a commendation from the Comanche Nation. From his features and body type, which would have been burly and bear-like even if he hadn't been carrying a certain excess above the belt, Anya suspected he was a member of the nation himself. She gathered they hadn't named this Comanche County for nothing.
Well, my condolences. I know that don't help much. All the times I've offered condolences over the years, I never yet figured out a way that actually does a body any good. I keep trying.
I appreciate it, Lieutenant. Really.
It was unusual for them to let you in to see him. But the ICU staff tells me he kept asking for you so insistently they figured it was best to let him see you.
Maybe that was a mistake.
He shook his head.
Well, there's no point second-guessing something like that, Miss Creed. That poor boy was pretty torn up. I don't reckon he could have lasted long, regardless of anything you did or didn't do.
Thanks.
She tried to ignore the stinging in her eyes.
I was coming out to visit him. He was also kind enough to want to consult with me on the dig, even though pre-Columbian North American archaeology is way outside my area of study.
Well, you're doing me a favor, Miss Creed, by coming out here to see me. I was needing to interview you anyway.
He put on a pair of heavy-framed reading glasses and moved his mouse around on the pad, peering at a flat-screen monitor set at an angle so as not to intrude between him and a visitor. Aside from an inbox stacked with papers, the only other objects on his desk were a picture of a grinning, young, and handsome Indian man wearing an army uniform, a much younger girl, maybe 12, with pigtails, both built along much more aerodynamic lines than the lieutenant, and another picture of a young man in BDUs and combat gear with a bullet-pocked adobe wall for a backdrop. The soldier held a Kar-4 assault carbine, decked out with the usual array of sights and lights. He looked like the same person as the grinning kid in the other photo, only older. Not so much in years, maybe, but still much older, Anya thought.
So, you work for a television show?
Yes, I'm kind of the resident skeptic, the token voice of reason. I suspect Paul's superiors hoped that by inviting me out, they might put their department in the way of some free publicity.
The Anthro department at OU wanted to get on something called Chasing History's Monsters?
The hope of getting on TV can have a strange effect on people, even intelligent, well-educated ones.
He made a face, took off the glasses, and looked at her.
Maybe the monster thing's actually appropriate now. Is that what brings you to see me, Ms. Creed?
I want to learn everything I can about what happened to my friend, also his colleagues, and the poor man whose property the dig site was on.
Old Eric. Pretty righteous guy. Did well for himself and his family from leasing natural gas rights on some of his land out there south of the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge. Always quick to help out a fellow nation member or crack a joke, even if he did have lousy taste in him.
He was a friend of yours?
Ten Bears nodded.
I know a lot of people in our region. Know a whole lot of Indian good old boys like me.
I'm sorry.
Thanks. Listen, it was a pretty ugly scene out there, Miss Creed. I've worked a lot of homicides over the years. I've worked some pretty terrible accident scenes. Never saw anything like that anywhere. I can't really tell you anything the department hasn't already released to the media. Tell the truth, I'm sort of glad.
He sat back, looking at her. He seemed not unfriendly, not unkind, in fact. From the laugh lines bracketing his eyes and mouth, she guessed he was by nature a pretty decent guy. She also knew that a seasoned homicide investigator wouldn't hesitate to feign those emotions when he didn't feel remotely kind or friendly if it would help advance the case.
What'd the decedent tell you?
He said he was attacked by what, frankly, sounded more like a movie monster than anything in the real world.
Yeah, and you've had some experience investigating monsters, I guess. What's your take on that?
Are you serious? I'm sorry, Lieutenant. I'm not trying to be uncooperative. It just sounds like a strange question for somebody who seems so no-nonsense to be asking.
I try not to close any possible avenues of inquiry, especially in a case like this. I'm not giving away any confidential information when I tell you we don't have a whole lot of ideas on this thing. Not ones that make any sense. So, hey, I'll at least give a listen to ones that might not seem to make much sense. I don't believe in werewolves. But if our perp really is a damn werewolf, I want to be there when they pump silver into his veins or whatever they'd use for an execution. Maybe you'd call it putting him to sleep.
Oh. Anya clapped her hand over her mouth. She bent forward in her chair, then straightened.
Sorry, I'm not normally like that.
Well, I'm sorry. Sometimes I've got pretty lousy taste in jokes, too. I can see you're shaken up some. Anybody would be. Nice young woman like you isn't used to having people up and die right in front of her.
Anya managed to show no reaction to that statement. Unfortunately, she was used to having people up and die in front of her. Poor Paul wasn't even the first ex-lover and friend Anya Creed had seen die, although she was sure she would never get used to that. She thought about the sword, her sword. Though it was hidden away in some otherwhere that she could reach into to retrieve it, she could feel the plain, unadorned hilt smooth and hard against her palm. All she had to do was close her hand, will the blade to come forth, and the weapon would be there. She had learned that it had once belonged to Joan of Arc, and that she was the inheritor of the long-ago martyr's mantle. On a research trip to France, she had, seemingly by chance, found the final piece of St. Joan's sword, broken to pieces by the English captors who burned her. When she came into the presence of the other pieces, she had miraculously healed the ancient blade, made it whole again out of fragments by no more than the touch of her hand. Anya had been told by a mystic named Rue that the sword brought a legacy with it, unfinished business that Joan had never had the chance to take care of. Anya didn't know if she believed that, but she did know that her life had changed after the sword had come into her possession. The sword belonged to her now, whatever that entailed exactly. Neither the sword nor her new life came with an owner's manual. She had always felt an impulse to protect the weak and defy the bully. Maybe that was her mission. It would do until something better came along. None of which she wanted to admit to the lead investigator on Comanche County's most lurid multiple murder case of modern times. The thought helped her compose herself.
This has hit me hard, I must admit. I have to ask you to believe me that I'm not going to pieces on you, and I'm determined to find out what happened to those people.
All right. So, not to be boring or anything, what do you make of what Mr. Stavriakos told you?
I don't believe in werewolves either, Lieutenant. Yet I know Paul Stavriakos was a trained scientist, and not what I'd call an impressionable man. Obviously something terrible and unusual happened out at the dig site this morning. The suddenness and speed of the attack, the shock of seeing his friends brutally murdered, the terrible emotional impact of having someone attack him in person, the physical injuries he took, none of those things leads to careful observation. The thing is, there are no documented reports of wolf attacks on humans in North America. And I have a hard time imagining any North American animal, no matter how hungry or scared or angry or even rabid, attacking a group of six adult humans, much less being able to kill or mortally wound them all. So I'd have to imagine a very strong man, berserk even, probably wearing a wolf skin or even some kind of costume, was responsible for the attack.
Anya shook her head.
It's hard for me to imagine what happened, no matter what.
Now, I've been doing some digging since I got back from interviewing Mr. Stavriakos at the hospital, before you got there. It turns out there are some pretty well-documented wolf attacks on people. Just a lot of people said there weren't, and everybody got to believe in it. But there hadn't been a wolf seen in Comanche County since the 1890s, and again, I'm not giving away much when I tell you that's how I got it sized up, too.
I understand from the news reports that there have been previous attacks under similar circumstances.
Yeah, two in New Mexico. One out near the Continental Divide between Gallup and Grants. One between Santa Fe and Albuquerque. All of them on archaeological digs. All of them nasty. Mr. Stavriakos' passing brings the death toll to 15. In all three attacks, at least one witness survived, and they all gave similar details, including that their attacker was either a great big wolf or something that looked like a man-wolf hybrid, like the Wolfman from the movie. Along with what you said, the whole notion it's a single animal with one hell of a range, much less three separate animals that suddenly and simultaneously developed a serious taste for archaeologists, strikes me as a lot more far-fetched than it's being a werewolf. We got evidence from all three attacks that tells us there was just the one perpetrator. To me, he's obviously got to be a crazy man in some kind of murder suit, like that old Zodiac killer gone Hollywood.
Ten Bear shifted in his swivel chair.
Public's gonna be crawling straight up our trouser legs on this one. And I don't even blame them. All we can do is try to keep calm, do good police work, let the forensics people do their thing, try to identify this killer and wrap him up before he can do this again. And barring that, hope that next time he tries, some good old boy archaeologist will pull an octagonal barrel Winchester out of the rifle rack of his pickup truck and let some badly needed sunlight into this bad boy's skull. If you'll pardon my speaking what you might call frankly.
Nothing I disagree with, Lieutenant. One thing, Paul seemed very specific that the attacker was a skinwalker. A Navajo wolf, he called it that, too. Beyond the fact that there are legends of skinwalkers, I don't know anything about that, or what might make Paul so positive that was what attacked him. Do you know anything about skinwalker myths?
Well, not much more than you. They're a Navajo thing, just like he said. Not something us Numenu Comanches would get up to, nor the Kiowa either. Not even Plains Apache, far as I know. They still speak an Apache language, but they picked up Plains Indian culture since they joined up with the Comanche and the Kiowa a couple of centuries back.
I want to see the site, Lieutenant.
He looked at her with frank appraisal.
Well, now, is this a personal thing? Or are you going to go for journalistic status, try the power of the press routine?
Whatever it takes. I want the killer caught. It is personal. Of course it is. I've consulted with investigative agencies before. I know enough to keep out of the way of real forensic investigators. And as an archaeologist, I certainly know how to avoid contaminating or disturbing a site. Also, I may be able to infer something from the dig that someone who isn't a trained and experienced archaeologist would miss.
His black eyes gazed at her for the space of several breaths.
I'm not proud, Miss Creed. Leastwise, not prouder than I am eager to save a whole bunch more poor folks from getting torn up like that. I could use any information I can get. So, let's go ahead and call you a consultant on this one. You need a contract?
She shook her head.
Nor do I need any fees. Let me use your name and back me up if I need it. I promise I won't embarrass you.
He nodded.
Well, that's good enough. And thanks for not asking for any money. Things are pretty tight, budgetarily speaking, even for a sensational case like this. I've worked with archaeologists before. Heck, I worked with Ted Watkins, the archaeologist who got killed out there this morning. So I know you understand about not trampling through a crime scene like a herd of buffalo. I wish half the law enforcement people who've been up through there already had half the sense about that kind of thing as you people do. I'll give you the little speech anyway. Stay out of the way of any cop types, whether they're troopers, county mounties, or, heaven help us, the feds. If you encounter the suspect, do not try to detain or interact with them, for God's sake. Otherwise, knock yourself out. And I'll put out the word you're helping me on a discreet kind of basis.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
I'm not sure it's a thinking matter, ma'am.
They both stood. He was a good 3 inches shorter than her. Anya nodded at the beefy revolver holstered at his right hip. It was matte silver metal with contoured wooden grips. They looked well-worn.
I couldn't help noticing you carry a double-action revolver, Lieutenant. Looking at the other troopers, I thought the Oklahoma Highway Patrol issued Glock 22s.
He looked as if her query surprised him. It clearly didn't displease him.
Smith & Wesson 657. It's a 41 Magnum in-frame stainless. Custom Hogue grips. Got me a special exemption from the department to carry it. Helps I'm a Comanche and all. Plus, I've been with the patrol since old Quanah Parker was a Lance Corporal. Now, I got nothing against the Glocks. I just like the authority the 41 Mag gives you. And maybe some of that cowboy wheel gun mystique.
He slapped the weapon affectionately.
This pup got me all the way through the fast drive to Kuwait City in 91. Not much call to use it then, although it was a power comfort to me. Been out of the holster a time or two since, though, and never once let me down.
Kuwait City, 1991? Wait, you were Force Recon?
Well, that's right, ma'am. You wouldn't be former military yourself, would you? Or from a service family. You seem to know a fair amount about the forces.
I have a lot of friends in the military. But you're a Marine.
She already knew better than to say ex-Marine.
Semper Fi, ma'am.
The young man in the photos on your desk is Army.
Ten Bear's thin-lipped mouth tightened ever so slightly, and his eyes narrowed just a hair.
Yeah, boy always did know how to piss me off, even if he did, McGranger.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant. I'll let you know if I find anything that I think you might be able to use.
You look like a woman who knows how to take care of herself.
I like to think I can.
Well, this isn't the time or the place to show how tough and independent you are.
What do you mean? Why?
There's a mass murderer on the loose. You didn't forget already.
No, I didn't.
I'm just joshing you about the forgetting part, not about the murderer. I don't think this fellow plays well with others.
I'll try to stay away from him.
You be sure to do that, and let us professionals handle him. We do a bad enough job without any help.
She wasn't sure quite how to take that. He seemed like a man who, for all his cockeyed banter, took his job very seriously. She also didn't think his tongue was more than halfway in his cheek, and wondered just who wasn't doing their job quite so well. She also knew better than to ask. Lieutenant Ten Bears clearly thought of himself as a stand-up cop. He'd never badmouth a fellow officer to an outsider. But he might not be above dropping some sidewise comments about his comrades who didn't measure up.
One more thing before you go. We got us some young South Plains Braves here in western Oklahoma who don't much like wide eyes. And they play rough. Tempers are extra short right now since some of them don't like it that we got us a great big new casino the nation's opening up in a few days.
He laughed at her expression.
Oh, don't worry. They can't fire me for calling them Braves. Any more than they can make us Indians call ourselves Native Americans. That fight we won, anyway. Maybe it's a trend.
Anya found herself liking the lieutenant. The site was a bust. The sun was setting when Anya got there. The only people present in the mellow dusk light slanting beneath gray clouds were some gloved techs moving gingerly around inside the yellow tape perimeter, whipped constantly by the wind, and a pair of Comanche County deputies in cowboy hats. Both were lean young men, one with hair cut so painfully short it suggested a recent military discharge, the other with gleaming black braids hanging over the dark brown shoulders of his jacket. They both gave her a rock-hard look.
Lieutenant Ten Bears sent me.
Having seen more than her share of interdepartmental rivalry in law enforcement, she wasn't sure how they'd respond. But they both instantly broke into smiles. When she showed them her ID, they readily allowed her access. The braided deputy perked up.
I've seen you on TV, Miss Creed.
He looked marginally older than his partner and was clearly senior.
I know you'll be careful. Not like some people we've had out here. And on a totally unrelated subject, the FBI just left. I reckon we're mainly out here to keep them federal boys from taking over altogether.
His partner shook his head.
I was surprised they didn't offer to tip us on the way out.
Inside the tape, the techs nodded brusquely toward her and went about their business. They kept studiously clear of the dig itself, marked off and gridded by string stretched between stakes. If she wasn't supposed to be there, they clearly reasoned, the county boys would never have let her step over the tape. The evidence team had jobs to do and not much daylight left to do them. She guessed nobody wanted to be out there with a generator going and stand lights shining as the temperature dropped and the prairie wind came up. She walked around with her arms crossed in front of her. The wind was indeed picking up as the sun fell toward the rumpled horizon in the west. The geographic region lay in the Red Beds Plains, which ran all the way from Kansas down across the Red River into Texas.
Unlike the true Great Plains farther north, this land was wide but rolling, dotted with small stands of trees. There weren't any signs of cultivation in view. This particular part of the Red Beds was walled off to the north by the rough granite ramparts built on a foundation of Cambrian sandstone beds of the Wichita Mountains. Anya's maps showed none of them got as high as 2,500 feet, and the general elevation of the landscape was around 1,000. To Anya, they were really just rugged hills by the standards of the ranges not far to the west in New Mexico and Colorado, much less the Andes and the Himalayas, which she also knew firsthand. But the locals seemed adamant about their mountain status, so she felt disinclined to argue.
Best not to make molehills out of their mountains.
There really wasn't much to see but some nasty dark splashes, now pretty dried out, on the short grass and the rocks. Where it was bare, the red soil had sucked the blood down without much trace she could see. Although the techs were taking samples, and the spots where blood spatter had been found were marked with little plastic tabs, as were the places where the bodies had been found. The dig team had been housed in a small RV, a trailer, and a small camper pickup. If there was any sign the attacker had entered any of them, Anya hadn't been told. She decided to keep clear of them. She wasn't looking for criminal evidence, and part of being a trained professional at site preservation meant minimizing the risk of messing anything up. She searched for tactical evidence. How had the attack happened? How had the killer come so swiftly on the six people, whose attention, the transcript of Ten Bear's interview with Paul indicated, had been innocently focused on coffee and donuts? Some blurred tracks in the dirt suggested the killer had gotten close by using the trailer for concealment before launching a blitz assault. If the tracks gave the investigators any clues as to the true nature of the monster, and whatever or whoever it was, there was no doubt it was a monster. They hadn't shared them with her. She didn't expect they would. Following a few quiet words from Ten Bears, the troopers at the Troop GHQ had also permitted Anya to see photos of the attack scene taken before the bodies were removed. They seemed surprised at how calmly she studied them. They affected her, but she was long past the point of breaking down from seeing butchery, no matter how horrific, especially not mere images. Now she tried to retrace the killer's steps. He had worked incredibly fast, ripping or slashing open state archaeologist Dr. Watkins' throat, then those of the two undergrads, Watts and Luttrell. Next, it attacked Allison York, eviscerating her at a single blow.
What moves that fast and that deadly?
All this occurred while Paul had his head turned, and apparently without his becoming aware of it. That was according to what he had told the trooper who rode with him in the helicopter when he was airlifted to Norman. The killer then struck Paul. The landowner, Eric James, apparently tried to jump the killer when he was attacking Anya's friend. The killer then knocked the Comanche man away, leaped on him, and savaged him before turning back to further maul his other victims. Even with the deadly advantages of surprise and shock, it had been a breathtakingly effective assault. Anya tried to envision what weapons the killer used. Did he carry knives or wear Freddy Krueger-style knife gloves? Did he actually bite his victims? The highway patrol had declined to divulge to Anya any such particulars. She understood. She had no need to know, and those were the very kinds of things investigators always tried to hold back, on the theory that they could trap the killer or authenticate any confession on the basis that he knew details about the crime no one else had access to except detectives. Also, it spared the victims' families reading about, or worse, seeing on TV too many horrific details about their loved ones' terrible last moments. Anya couldn't see the murderer in her mind. Just a blur, blood, people falling. In her mental movie, there was no soundtrack. She felt grateful for that. Having gotten what little she could from the murder scene, Anya raised her face to the wind and looked around. The site was along an ancient dry stream bed that ran from northwest to southeast. The trailer was parked on the north of the dig team's camp, forming an upside-down U with the camper on the west side and the RV on the east. There was a pretty short line of approach to the humpback trailer from the natural cover provided by the northerly rise and some rocks and tall weeds. Anya nodded politely to the evidence techs, then climbed carefully back over the flapping yellow tape and made her way up the little slope to the north. She found another area marked off by yellow tape fluttering between plastic pickets. Tracks, blurred and indistinct. She realized they'd no doubt been broken down from having impressions taken. She walked around, trying to survey with an attacker's eye. It wasn't an entirely unfamiliar operation to her. The approach and setup to the attack had been dead easy. The dig camp had been sighted with no remote notion that defense could conceivably be necessary in a normal, orderly, law-abiding universe. The victims had not bothered keeping a lookout. Not even their genial host, secure in the midst of his own domain, unlike his ancestors of a century before, who had found themselves chivied constantly from one ever-shrinking sanctuary to the next. The fact he'd carried his own Marlin lever-action carbine in a saddle scabbard on his horse, which had bolted back to the barn after the attacker spooked it, suggested nothing of paranoia or even wariness to Anya. It was just a Western thing. He did it because he could, and because it came naturally to him. She began to walk around the camp, periodically coming across more recovered tracks. Using the brushy, rocky terrain, the killer had circled around and around, scoping his target. That part, at least, had been painfully simple. He'd stalked them like a cougar hunting sheep, waited in the strange, almost submarine pre-dawn light until he was sure all his prey had come out of their shelters and clumped into a nice, compact group. Then he slipped down to his final line of departure, crept to the rear of the trailer, and attacked. He'd probably rehearsed the whole event in his mind, crouching there by the trailer. Savored it like a hungry man's anticipation of a juicy steak. Reveled in the sense of power, of knowing something those poor, hapless people didn't know. They were about to die.
You're not a profiler.
But Anya had stalked human prey before, and killed. They were all violent men, sometimes women. Not victims, but victimizers. They were always wary, those whose lives she took, and always armed. By contrast, the Wolfman was picking easy prey. Like any standard-issue serial killer who picked prostitutes to murder because they'd voluntarily get in the car with him.
Isn't that what any successful predator does?
Such moments of identification as this, with a being who epitomized the very evil she lived to fight against, chilled her worse than the rapidly cooling prairie wind. She shook her head. A strand of her long chestnut hair had worked its way loose from her ponytail. The wind whipped it ticklingly across her face. The same wind teased her with little voices that hinted at meaning, but never revealed it. The western sky was changing from blood to mauve. The sun was long gone. It was time to emulate it. She went back to her rental car, waved to the deputies, and drove away. Anya slammed a palm on the steering wheel. The rented car's motor was jerking and coughing. Jouncing along the no-name dirt track, severely rutted before even the spring rains came in earnest, wasn't making the car any happier. The day's final remnants were a line of hot iron red glow along the western hills. Overhead, the sky shaded from indigo to starshot black. Some clouds, their bottoms showing just a faint yellowish glow of artifact light, were sweeping in from the east, piling up darkly as if to show bad intentions.
Don't do this to me. I don't want to hike up to the highway in freezing rain.
The country was getting seriously hilly, preparatory to becoming the Wichitas. Highway 62, which ran from Lawton straight as a leveling laser west and formed the southern boundary of a spur of the military reservation that stuck out under the wildlife refuge, still lay, as closely as she could reckon, 3 miles north. And it was cold. Despite the heater, she could feel the chill beating off the car windows like a negative furnace. For the dozenth time, she hauled out her phone. Still no bars. The GPS was frozen. Ahead, to her considerable relief, she saw artificial lights. A red and yellow oasis in a sea of dark. They weren't bright lights, but then again, this definitely wasn't the big city. It wasn't even the town of Cash, whose glow was faintly visible a few miles north, with its booming population of 2,400. The flickering red neon sign read, Bad Medicine Bar and Grill. Below the battered sign stood a rectangular shack with a slanted tin roof, fronted by a wooden porch under a sway-backed roof of planks. As her rental lumped and bucked closer, she saw there were no actual cars in the parking lot. There was a pickup truck and a minivan, not too unexpected in this part of the world, and another pickup hunched in the shadows out back. Dominating the dirt and gravel lot were at least a score of motorcycles shining in the light of the sign. The long, low-slung beasts had heavily modified frames with burly V-twin engines. With pride of place in the middle of the pack sat the least visibly modified bike of the lot, a big Indian motorcycle with the trademark metal fairings over the tires. It looked to Anya's none-too-expert eye like an original, not one of the never-too-successful attempts to revive the design, or at least the brand. She went inside. The first things to hit her were heat and the slam of heavy metal music blasting from a jukebox. Anya pushed on inside and let the door swing closed behind her.
At least it's warm.
After the darkness of the plains night, the bar's dimly lit interior was still pretty dim. She paused just inside the door a moment to get her bearings. As the place resolved out of gloom, she noticed it followed through with the outside's deliberately rustic look. With a wood ceiling and exposed rafters, bolstered in place by square columns, so rough-cut they looked as if you'd get splinters if you brushed up on one. It had the usual split-back vinyl barroom chairs, tables to match the architecture, a bar with a long fly-specked mirror behind it. Bare bulbs cast a faint yellowish glow from lamps hung from the ceiling. Most of the illumination seemed to emanate from the jukebox beside her, which pulsated with polychromatic lights. Glancing down, she saw the floor was actually wood planks, with sawdust on it, no less. Like the Old West Saloon, the joint was obviously trying hard to emulate. Her mental tracking system had already located the bar's occupants. A few bellied up to the bar on foot or rickety-looking wood stools. The rest clustered around tables or kibitzed, while a short, wide man with a black bandana tied around his head lined up a shot on the pool table in the far corner. Everyone in view but the bartender was dressed in the standard dark-hued biker drag. She could tell that much at a flash impression. She realized the truck and van outside were probably support vehicles for the club. Any joking and talking had stopped when she entered.
Time to break the ice. That's a nice Indian out front.
Then she stopped dead. There were nothing but Indians inside the bar, and they looked anything but nice. Everyone stared at Anya, with nothing resembling a smile or eye twinkle in sight. She was quite aware she may have just said the wrong thing. It was the classic situation where any attempt at explanation could only make things worse.
Right then. Sorry to intrude. My car broke down. My cell phone isn't getting a signal.
She held the offending object up by her face and waved it.
I'll just borrow the phone, make a quick call, and get out of your way.
She was deliberately playing typical and airhead tourist, in hopes they'd think her an idiot too innocuous to be worth bothering with. Not a great plan. But no really great options jumped up to present themselves either. She stepped up to the bar, noting that the two burly men next to her had colors on the backs of their old-school bad biker denim jackets that showed an Indian warrior bestriding an Indian motorcycle. It looked suspiciously like the bike parked out front, shooting a bow. The legend on the back of the nearer biker read, Iron Horse People MC, Comanche Nation. The other was similar, but substituted Kiowa for Comanche. The bartender was a white guy, skinny as an alley cat, with craggy features and wild white hair. He looked white anyway. Anya knew of numerous people who had been born into full membership of their respective tribes who looked no more native. His blue eyes were piercing and unwelcoming when they turned on Anya. He didn't ask her pleasure.
May I borrow the phone, please?
He jerked his head.
Payphone. Booth in the back.
She raised a surprised eyebrow. In this cell phone era, payphones were becoming an endangered species.
It's a dead zone.
The voice came from a biker who stood farther away from Anya to her right. He was a big bear-like guy with his black hair hanging free to his shoulders in twin braids.
And we like it that way.
With a shock, Anya noticed, more than a beat late, one of the very sort of details she was normally adept at picking up on quickly. He wore a semi-automatic pistol holstered on his left hip. A Sig Sauer, she thought. She realized just about everyone in the bar was packing. She was pretty sure it was a violation of Oklahoma law to carry a firearm into an establishment that served alcohol. She decided not to bring it up. Anya turned in the direction indicated by the bartender and headed for a niche sunk in a plank wall beside a faded and torn poster for a bullfight in Madrid in September 1963. Suddenly, she found herself blocked by a figure a good 3 inches taller than she was. It was a woman, with hair bound back from a long, strikingly beautiful face with high, exotic cheekbones and long, narrow eyes. She looked to Anya as if she came from a North Plains nation, Cheyenne maybe. Despite the weather outside, she wore a black tank top under a denim vest. Where lots of bikers sported U.S. flag patches, she wore a yellow and red Gadsden flag, the one with the snake and the motto, "Don't Tread on Me." She had, Anya felt, a somewhat snaky appearance in general. She was smaller in the chest and hips than Anya, and moved with sinuous grace that suggested the serpentine. The metaphor was extended by tattoos that twined from her biceps down her bare brown forearms. Rattlesnakes, striking with fangs sticking straight out from their gaping jaws, like Kiowa lances.
Excuse me.
Anya started to go around. The woman seemed to flow in front of her again.
The Wadas made us sign away our ancient right of roaming for reservations. Then they cheated us out of those and turned us out. So we tend to be a bit territorial these days. And you're off your reservation here, White Eyes. This is Indian country.
Yes, that whole land grab thing sucked. Neither of us was alive back then, so it's probably way too late to debate it, isn't it? Well, if you'll excuse me.
Anya sidestepped once again. To her relief, the woman didn't move to intercept her. Anya noted the 1911-style Springfield Armory 45 that rode in a black Kydex holster on her left hip. A gunfighter's rig for an old-school gunfighter's piece. Anya made for the payphone, only to see that the bear-like guy had stopped playing pool and had slipped into the booth. She realized with a start that he didn't have a shirt on beneath his own denim vest, and that his considerable paunch was covered in an intricate blue tattoo. He showed her a happy grin.
Sorry.
He trapped the handset between his shoulder and ear.
I gotta call my broker and see how much money I lost on stocks today. I'm still waiting on my own personal bailout.
He punched a number and pretended to listen. All the while, he smiled beatifically at Anya out of his wide, round face. Anya found it much scarier than the snake woman.
You should probably go.
After a moment, Anya nodded.
You're right.
She turned and started to walk out. Discretion, in this case, was the better part of staying alive. Anyway, I can hike to the highway much better if both my legs aren't broken, she told herself. A young biker emerged from a dark, oblong opening in the back wall next to the phone booth. He was tall and straight, long-legged and narrow-waisted in his blue jeans, broad-shouldered in his colors. Unlike almost everybody else in the bar, men or women, he wore his long black hair unbound in a straight, gleaming fall down his back. He was, undeniably, gorgeous. From his carriage, from the way the feeling in the room suddenly shifted, he was clearly the boss. His dark chocolate eyes locked on Anya's.
Who the hell are you?
She made a beeline for the door, away from him. She felt a strong hand clamp on her right biceps.
not so fast.
The biker chieftain spun her around.
I got a few questions.
Anya used the momentum imparted by his yanking her around to jam her left knee into his groin really hard. Clearly, her victim didn't remotely expect any such response. He collapsed to the floor. Despite herself, Anya was impressed by her results. Unfortunately, the entire bar full of rough Indian outlaw bikers were too. And after a beat or two of goggling at their pack leader, lying there helplessly on the sawdust-covered planks, they got pissed.
She dropped Johnny. Get her!
A heavy weight landed on Anya's shoulders, staggering her. She jackknifed forward, pulling hard on a handful of hair. A figure flew over her back to slam on the planks in a cloud of sawdust. Anya saw it was a woman. Hands clutched at Anya from several directions. A hand grabbed her jacket. Somebody yanked her hair. She slapped the hands away, lashing out with quick jabs and back fists. All the time, she waded through the crowd toward the door.
Stop her!
But Anya was fast and very determined. She sent tables and chairs spinning to the sawdust in her wake. In a few steps, she reached the door. If the pursuit didn't develop too quickly, she'd try to start the bulky car and get as far as she could. If that didn't pan out, she'd run off into the hills. Outlaw bikers weren't famous for their cross-country running abilities. And their motorcycles, heavy and low-slung, as a lot of them were themselves, were optimized for high-speed cruising on paved road. The opposite of dirt bikes, they'd quickly bog down in the rolling landscape. Anya liked her chances of evading the Iron Horse people in the dark. Whatever they might like to pretend, they weren't their ancestors, wild children of the wind, grass, sun, and moon. They were products of the same modern cell phone and flat-screen culture she was. She neared her car, and suddenly men stood from behind it. The bar's sign's jittery pink glow glistened on faces painted black, and on the knives and hatchets in their hands. From the footsteps and angry shouts, she understood a bunch more bad guys had crowded in between the vehicles behind her. She'd fled just in time. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a brighter light stretched across the gravel from the direction of the bar's sagging facade. The front door was opening.
Dog soldiers!
That was the most fortuitous diversion Anya could ever have hoped for. She had a flare of hope that the sudden discovery of the dog soldiers, whoever they were, and the consternation that caused among the Iron Horse people would cleanly cover her getaway. Anya never broke stride. She had her plan and she followed through. She ran straight to the back of the car, cut around behind it, and then, when she was sure she was out of everybody's sight, beelined right up a low ridge nearby and was gone with the wind. Even though Anya's GPS, built into her phone, stayed AWOL, she was not lost. She could see the bright yellow glow of Lawton to the east. The clouds actually made that a better beacon by providing a handy surface to reflect the city lights. As long as Anya kept that glow, the largest in the vicinity in any direction, on her right, she knew she was heading north, toward the graded earth country road and eventually the highway. She wondered whether the two groups of crazy outlaws back at the bar might sort things out enough to give chase to her. It was so frigid in the wind and rain that it felt as if her bones would break. She knew the bikers might be the least of her problems. Every time the chill grew intolerable, she picked up the pace a notch. Even though she reckoned later she hadn't been hiking even 20 minutes after what seemed an eternity, she reached the country road. She walked on, hoping to eventually get a signal on her cell phone. Approaching from the right, a quarter mile off, she spotted a pair of headlights. Coming out of the east made it unlikely the car was chasing her from the bar. There was always the frightening possibility that it might contain reinforcements for either set of her enemies. That concern died away as she saw the Lawton sky glow reflect through the light bar atop the car as it neared her. It slowed as if to come to a stop beside her, Even before it did, Anya recognized, illuminated by the multicolored lights of the onboard computer and dashboard, the indefatigably cheerful face of Lieutenant Tom Tenbears.
It's a little cold out to be hitchhiking, ain't it, Ms. Creed?
Yes.
Anya hugged herself tightly against the biting cold. She wasn't really in the mood for a lot of ironic repartee.
Well, hop on in and get warm, why don't you?
She could think of any number of reasons why she wouldn't, actually. None of them was as compelling as either getting out of the cold or putting the symbolic bulk of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol between her and the bikers and midnight ambushers. She wasn't naive enough to believe a lone trooper in a cruiser would necessarily deter them. But along with his 41 Smith & Wesson, Ten Bears had a radio.